Hi, I'm Helena, and with me today is not Nick, but one of my other colleagues, and this is Gemma. Hi, Gemma.
Hi, I'm Gemma. I work in the information team here at the MS Trust, and it's really nice to finally feature on our podcast.
Yes, it's very exciting to have you with me today. As Gemma mentioned, we are both work here at the MS Trust, which is a charity for people affected by MS in the UK, and we are here to help you make sense of MS.
Yep, and we'd like to welcome you to our podcast, Multiple Sclerosis, Breaking It Down. This podcast brings together a range of voices from the MS community, so we cover all aspects of life with multiple sclerosis. We feature a combination of expert advice and real-life experiences from people with MS. Episodes provide an in-depth insight into the impact MS symptoms can have and how they can be successfully managed.
And the reason why Gemma is with me today is because we're doing a bit of a female takeover of Breaking It Down. We're going to be talking about women's health and MS. I actually wanted to call this episode's What Hormones Gotta Do With It. I'm not going to try and sing it like the song. But and I was excited about having Gemma with me because Gemma has been doing a lot of work on our website with about these topics in the past, so I thought it was nice to bring her on to the show.
Yeah, nice to finally be here. But yeah, I think this is a really important topic, as we know that MS is more common in women than in men, so it's possible that the sex hormones that distinguish women and men, like estrogen for example, might play some sort of role in this. So we know that the research suggests that women of reproductive age are three times more likely to develop MS than men. But interestingly, before puberty and after the menopause, the rates in women and men are about the same. So that suggests there's an hormonal element at play somewhere there. And then other research in pregnancy suggests that women with MS usually experience less disease activity when they're pregnant, but then sort of after the birth, the relapse rate can increase a little bit. So again, that suggests there's some sort of hormonal element at play as well. I think overall, women throughout their lives experience some big hormonal changes, whether that's the menstrual cycle, pregnancy, breastfeeding, postpartum period, the menopause. And I think it's really important to talk about the effect of all these hormonal changes and the impact that they can actually have on MS. And when these changes are happening, I'm sure there'll be many women with MS that are wondering, oh gosh, how is this going to affect my MS? So I think it's great that we're talking about this today. And hopefully by talking about it, we can sort of encourage more research to happen as well.
Yeah, I think that's the main thing that you don't really know. Is this MS? Is this, you know, is this my period? Is it menopause? It's pregnancy. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, definitely.
So there's a lot to talk about today. I guess we're starting from periods all the way through to the menopause.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. So today we're going to feature two guests on the podcast. So I chat to a consultant neurologist, Professor Ruth Dobson. She has been on the podcast before when we spoke a bit about the menopause and MS. In this episode, though, we sort of tackled lots of sort of hormone related topics. So we spoke about women's hormones more generally. We spoke about the menstrual cycle and the impact on MS symptoms. We spoke about a little bit about fertility treatment and how the hormonal medications that are used in that can impact on MS. We speak a lot about the safety of disease modifying drugs in pregnancy, and also symptomatic treatments in pregnancy as well. I think sometimes that can be a bit forgotten about. We spoke about birth plans and pain treatment options, a little bit about breastfeeding, and then a little bit about menopause at the end as well.
You basically covered everything.
Yeah, very, very detailed interview. So yeah, lots of topics there.
Fantastic. And I spoke to Livy, who was diagnosed with MS shortly after giving birth to her daughter. But before we listen to that interview, shall we just listen to Professor Ruth Dobson, because there clearly is a lot to go through here.
So today we're here with Ruth Dobson, and we're talking about women's health and multiple sclerosis. So Ruth is a professor of clinical neurology and a consultant neurologist, and she has an interest in this area. So we're going to ask Ruth a few questions, and it's basically going to be sort of a journey through a woman's life and how MS might impact various stages of a woman's life. So we're going to be talking a bit about hormones, periods, pregnancy, breastfeeding, postpartum support, and then a little bit about menopause at the end. So thank you so much, Ruth, for joining us today.
No worries. Nice to be here.
So we're going to start off by talking about hormones. So we know that MS is more common in women than in men. So do hormones play a role in this, and what does the research say?
So as you say, MS is almost three times as common in women than men, and there must be some reason for this. And we see this across many diseases where the immune system is affected. So things like rheumatoid arthritis, like lupus, are also more common in women than men. One of the biggest differences between women and men is the hormones and their hormonal profile. And this drives a lot of the kind of other physical and physiological differences that we see. So it makes sense that hormones are implicated. But we don't really know the details of how this is. I think also events over a woman's life, the way that MS sort of changes during life, and the fact that actually in children before puberty, it's equally common in males and females. And then after puberty, after those hormonal changes become really apparent, the sex difference starts to appear. Again, points us towards hormones being important in this in some way and driving inflammation possibly. What we also see actually is we also see that in people who present with progressive MS from the start, actually that sex difference, the sex ratio, disappears to quite a large extent. And actually it's sort of, you know, the proportion of men and women being affected by progressive MS from onset is much more similar. So there's probably something about hormones and inflammation and hormonal inflammation influences on that inflammation underpins much of MS.
Well, it's really interesting. And sticking on the topic of hormones then, so we are contacted on our helpline by women that are affected, their MS symptoms are affected by the menstrual cycle. So sometimes women find that their symptoms worsen when they're on their period. Why is this? And do you have any sort of tips for women that deal with these fluctuating symptoms in their cycle?
Yeah, so I think this is really important. And this is something that can definitely have quite a big impact on people's quality of life. I think when answering this, it's also important to say that we see this not just with MS, actually, but with a whole range of neurological diseases. So we see in some people with epilepsy, for example, they may get more seizures around the time of their period, or people with migraine. Migraines, again, can be very closely related to people's periods. And the other important sort of, I guess, flip side of that is that's not true for everyone. There are definitely some people where their periods aren't responsible, aren't implicated, aren't there in terms of fluctuating symptoms. And I think this is one thing where it's really important to recognize as a clinician that everybody's individual. So it's not, this can't happen, and it's not that this always happens. If it happens, it happens. And if it doesn't, then it doesn't. In general, when things are getting worse around the period, sometimes it can be due to changing body temperature around the time of people's periods. Sometimes it can be, you know, just the fluid shifts and things like that you have kind of as part of your menstrual cycle can really accentuate certain symptoms. And also we know that people are affected by periods in all kinds of ways that we can't really explain or understand, and we end up just with what feels like a slightly generic response of, oh, it must be due to the hormone fluctuations. But it probably is in some ways, and different people are sort of vulnerable to that in different ways. In terms of what to do about it, I think it's finding a solution that's right for that person. Some people with other neurological conditions where their periods might affect it find that things get dramatically better when they take hormonal contraception, such as the pill, such as IUSs like Mirena that stop periods from happening. And, you know, depending on the rest of your circumstances, it may be that is something that can help. Other people, you know, particularly with migraine, may find that these things actually make it worse. So there is an element of trial and error a little bit to try and work out what works for you as a person, rather than saying this is the definite right answer for everyone. And sometimes just knowing and having that knowledge and being able to plan around, you know, well, actually, for these couple of days a month, I'm going to feel really rotten. So maybe those aren't the days that I sort of go into work, do lots of other stuff. You know, maybe those days that I try and keep things a bit more on the down low. and being able to plan a bit can be quite helpful as well.
They're all really useful tips there for people. Moving on a little bit in terms of women who are looking to start a family. This is quite a big question, I suppose. So what is the guidance for people that women that want to start a family and disease modifying drugs? So should they be stopping, delaying treatment while they're trying for a baby, or should they be sort of making sure the MS is under control first before they think about trying for a baby? What's the general guidance for that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a massive question, really a podcast on its own, to go through all of that. And I think it's about taking all of those things into account, which is, I'm aware, a bit of a non-answer in a way. But our knowledge around the safety and the use of disease-modifying therapy during, you know, family planning, during pregnancy and the postpartum period has really increased hugely over the past few years. So I think that's one really important thing to say. And it's going to continue to increase. So whatever I say now will probably be out of date in about 6 months. So I do want people who are listening and watching this to be aware of that, that actually the information does change over time. In general, we know, or we understand, that the getting your MS under control with disease-modifying therapy if needed prior to trying to conceive is ideal. But that's got to be balanced against the chances of getting pregnant and conceiving, because for some people, they may not have time, you know, particularly if you're a bit older, if you've sort of put family on hold earlier for other reasons unrelated to your MS, you know, it may be that actually you need to just start trying to conceive, because to put things on hold and then not, you know, not have a baby because you put things on hold, that's, you know, that's absolutely not what we're aiming for. There are certain DMTs that are safe to take around conception. And there are certain DMTs that your neurologist may advise you to continue into pregnancy. On the flip side, there are others that we would absolutely not recommend taking when you're trying to conceive. Okay, so drugs like fingolimod being one of them. And then there are induction therapies where we may advise people not to try to conceive while they're receiving the 2 years of therapy, but after then they wouldn't necessarily be on any treatment. And that might be, you know, a really appropriate choice for someone who maybe thinks, well, not sure about having children now, but in a couple of years, that's where I want to be in my life. So really the advice that's given around DMT use depends on people's personal situation, on age, on how active your MS is, on, you know, your support networks, on what your family plans are at that time. So it's really difficult to give a short answer to that question. But in general, preferable to have your MS under control if you can, and if you have time to achieve that before trying to conceive. Yeah. And for someone who's maybe newly diagnosed, who's younger, who has very active disease, we may say, you know, would you be able to put this on hold for 6 months while we try and get things a bit under control? Mm-hmm. Somebody maybe with milder disease who's maybe a bit older might say, well, you know, actually time isn't on your side, so crack on.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very individual to the person, and there's lots to consider. And yeah, obviously something that should be done in consultation with your neurologist and trying to work out what's best for you.
And I think sometimes, and I've definitely had people with MS who this has really helped them. The diagnosis of MS has really proved a catalyst to think about these things in detail. So, you know, people who are maybe thinking a bit about this but haven't thought about it a lot. And as a neurologist, it's not my job to do that thinking for you. That's for someone to do with their family, with their loved ones, between clinic appointments. Mm-hmm. But you know, for somebody who's very newly diagnosed, who it's all a bit much, you know, it's one of those things where it's saying, well, you know, we can never map out our lives, but maybe this is, you know, this is a prompt to think about when you might want this to happen, because that can, and for some people, should play a part in deciding which DMT you might go for.
Yeah. Yeah. It almost forces a little bit of forward planning, doesn't it?
Exactly.
My next question is around fertility treatment. So we know MS generally doesn't affect fertility, but it's possible that someone can have another condition that does affect their fertility, or their partner might have a condition that affects it. So is it possible for someone, is it okay for someone with MS to go through fertility treatment like IVF? And can any of the hormone medications involved affect a woman's MS?
Yeah, so this is an increasingly common question. I think people are increasingly accessing fertility treatment. This is outside of MS, but just yep. generally, as the age at which people start families is getting older, and as the sort of openness and funding around fertility treatment increases slightly. And also, it's really important to remember that actually fertility treatment for many people is an enabler to get pregnant within same-sex partnerships and things like that. So it's actually a huge broad spectrum of people who might be asking about fertility treatment. And it's also, that means that sort of fertility treatment covers a huge broad spectrum of tests and of interventions. So the fertility treatment that might be given for a same-sex couple to allow them to get pregnant may be very different from someone who's had years and years of unexplained fertility. So, you know, that there's a lot of complexity around fertility treatment and around the kind of treatments that are offered. And again, similar to MS treatments, these are constantly evolving. So fertility treatments now are not where they were 10 years ago. And I think that's a really important place to start, actually, to say that the evidence that was generated 10 or more years ago was really based on quite different protocols from the protocols that are now used in terms of the hormonal manipulation. And some of that's based around, you know, what works best, and also balancing some of the risks and benefits of fertility treatment for the people undergoing that. It's been really reassuring over the past couple of years. Actually, there's been a couple of really big studies out showing that, in contrast to previous work, fertility treatments appear not to increase the risk of MS relapse. And this is particularly in people who receive disease-modifying therapy up to the point of embryo transfer, or have well-controlled MS up to the point of embryo transfer. So again, it goes back to one of the points that I made earlier about making sure MS is under control should be sort of fairly high up on that priority list, along with achieving pregnancy and sort of successful pregnancy. And the reason for this kind of shift in evidence, I think, is due to a few things. I think it's due to the fact that more people and more neurologists, more patients and more fertility doctors are comfortable with continuing MS treatment for longer during fertility procedures.
Okay.
So previously, people would withdraw from all treatment before even starting any fertility procedures. Now, increasingly, people are comfortable to continue treatments for longer during this, which then reduces the risk of relapse, because once the embryo transfers happen, there is sort of a relative protection from pregnancy. I think it's also that, you know, we're diagnosing more people with MS, but we're diagnosing sort of people with MS at the milder end of the spectrum more. So I think that's partly shifting it. And I do think it's the changes in fertility treatments as well, that we've got better at knowing exactly which bit of fertility treatments work and finessing that, rather than having a sort of very large hammer which to use. But the data is reassuring, and there's some data from the States where they looked really in great detail across a range of fertility treatments with varying degrees, if you like, of hormonal manipulation, and saw with all of those that the MS appeared to be unaffected by those. Those women were mainly treated during at least some of their fertility journey. And then the large French study had less detail, but looked at a very large number of people with MS receiving fertility treatment, and actually found the relapse rate was completely flat or even lower post-fertility treatment in the people that had received DMT within the months prior to fertility treatment. So again, showing that probably in people where people are really actively and well treated from both an MS and fertility point of view, we can be very reassuring about this. Mm. And I think that's really important, because I think for anyone undergoing fertility treatment, it's a big thing. It's a big psychological stress. It's a big physical stress. It's a big emotional stress. And adding the worry around MS and control of MS on top of that is an extra huge thing for something that is, you know, one of the most stressful things that people do anyway. So I think it's really important actually to be able to say, well,
yeah,
you know, let's treat the MS, sure, but let's try and not worry about that too much. I think fertility doctors do still worry a lot about inadvertently causing harm, and they will often ask people, you know, well, can you check with your neurologist if this is okay? You know, can you make sure this is okay? Which, you know, many neurologists will be happy to do so, but I think because of the way our health system works, that responsibility often does fall upon the person with MS, the person undergoing fertility treatment, really to liaise between the two.
Yeah. Well, it's really good to hear that there's actually research that's reassuring for people that are looking at fertility treatment. Moving on a little bit to women that are pregnant now. So if a woman got pregnant while taking a DMD, what steps would they have to take? Would they have to suddenly stop treatment, or can they continue with treatment? Will the baby be safe? Or does this all sort of depend on what treatment they're on?
So I think it depends is the short answer. The slightly longer answer is you shouldn't suddenly stop your DMT.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead have a conversation and reach out to your neurology team via your MS nurse, MS coordinator, whatever your point of contact is within that service, to really discuss that. We know that not every pregnancy is planned. So we know that some people will not have had that conversation before getting pregnant. That's okay. That's fine. You know, even within my clinics, where I really do try and make that a part of the conversation, I definitely get surprised every so often where somebody comes in and sort of announces their pregnancy, which I wasn't expecting and wasn't aware they were trying. So I think, you know, don't feel like you're going to get judged for not having discussed it before. Don't feel like you're going to, you know, this is a thing. But actually, it's really important that you have the information as somebody living with MS who's taking that treatment, and that your views are taken into account. You know, some people feel very strongly that they wouldn't want to continue treatment during pregnancy, that actually they would want to come off their disease modifying therapy. And for many people, that's completely fine. I think it does sometimes require a discussion around whether you should sort of come off everything, whether you should switch to something with proven safety benefit during pregnancy. And some people, on the other hand, feel very strongly that they would never want to come off treatment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's potentially also fine. But again, it's a similar discussion. You know, is this treatment safe to continue during pregnancy? Are there ways that we can change treatment schedules to ensure the best safety that we can during pregnancy? So it's about really giving you as a person with MS that information to make a decision together with your neurologist, your neurology team about what is best for you.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though I said earlier, you know, the amount of evidence is increasing, it's still, you know, the evidence is still not as good as some of the other evidence that we have around treatment in MS. So it's making sure that you know what we know and what we don't know.
Mm-hmm. That's really interesting. And in terms of other treatments, so if someone's, taking medications for pain or muscle stiffness, for instance, would they need to stop those medications if they became pregnant?
Yeah, so there are a huge number of medications that people with MS might be on.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that. And really, it depends medication by medication. In general terms, what we aim for is we aim for sort of the minimum amount of medication during pregnancy. And sometimes when people are planning pregnancy, they may choose to switch some of the medications. They may choose to try and reduce them to the minimum amount during pregnancy. If you find yourself unexpectedly pregnant without sort of having thought about it before, again, it's about discussing each of those medications in turn. There's some really useful information online. So there's a website called Bumps, which actually gives information about medication use in pregnancy. It's written in a very accessible format. So actually, you know, as someone with MS, you can actually type in the name of your medication and it will tell you what the evidence is around the use of that medication in pregnancy, what the risks and the benefits are. And with a lot of the symptomatic medications, you know, the benefits really are in terms of how you feel as someone with MS, how you feel on a day-to-day basis. You know, we talk about disease-modifying therapies and the long-term benefits and the inflammatory activity. With the symptomatic medication, you know, the benefit is to you as a person and being able to live your daily life as you wish to do it. And so there is an element of that is much more personal mm-hmm. about whether you really feel that actually this benefit is worth it. So, you know, it is important to have those discussions.
Yeah, I think it is a very personal thing, isn't it? And it's reassuring that there are options for people that might really struggle with pain, for instance, might not be an option. And yeah,
maybe that the medication that you're taking isn't the right one to continue all the way through during pregnancy. Mm. You have to do a switch. And, you know, in an ideal world, you do these switches before you get pregnant. But if that's not possible, then it's still possible to switch medications during pregnancy.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's not that we say, no, you absolutely cannot take everything. It's saying, well, this is probably the least risky way to approach medication.
Yeah.
You know, the amount that you're taking overall.
Yeah. So there are still options there. So moving on a little bit to a woman with MS that's pregnant and is looking at their birth plan. So in labour, there are sort of a range of treatment options for pain that are available. Would someone with MS be sort of able to have any of those options, for instance, an epidural?
Yes, absolutely. So I think sometimes people with MS come up with concern from obstetric or anaesthetist teams around epidurals and around the risk of bringing on a relapse. But we now understand from very large data that the epidurals are not associated with increased relapse risk in the postpartum period, nor a spinal anaesthesia. Instead, it's that we know that people are more likely to have a relapse postpartum, and and that's sort of what drives that worry, if you like. And so epidurals are fine, spinals are fine. In general, what I say to my people with MS in clinic is that, you know, think about you and what you want. Okay. There are very few birth options that shouldn't be available to you as somebody with MS. It may be that for some people, because of specific physical challenges that they might experience either as a result of their MS or because of something else, or other medical conditions that people might have, or other factors, that there may be some birth options that aren't recommended. But MS in itself, particularly, you know, MS in people who have very little disability, actually should have all birth options available to you, including, you know, home birth according to local services, including midwife-led unit, or all of those things should be available. But it's really that discussion that centers around you as a person, what challenges you might face. You know, some people who really struggle with fatigue might feel that actually they, you know, want to go for assisted birth earlier than they might otherwise do because of their fatigue. But that should be your choice as a person. It shouldn't be somebody saying to you, well, you have MS, therefore you must have fatigue, therefore you must do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, well, what symptoms do you have? What symptoms do you live with? What are your worries? So thinking about your birth plan from the perspective of what you're experiencing, how your MS is with you,
mm-hmm.
rather than saying, well, I've got MS, so this is what I must do.
Yeah. Yeah. That leads quite nicely onto our next question. So if a woman with MS, if the MS affects their mobility and they're pregnant and they're thinking about their birth plan, is it possible for them to get extra support or equipment sort of to help them during labour if they want to sort of keep mobile or get into certain positions? Or should a C-section be considered? How do they sort of set up that sort of support?
Yeah, so I think that... In this case, it would really be a discussion with the obstetric team and the midwifery team. So obstetric teams, and particularly medical obstetric teams, sort of looking after people with chronic conditions, have really become much better set up over the past 5 years. And I think that particularly people with more disability, as you say, where people might have, you know, problems with mobility, problems getting into certain positions, should be offered the chance to have a full and frank discussion with the obstetric and midwifery team about the specific challenges that they might face. And potentially in quite a lot of depth around specific situations. So, you know, if you're getting tired, what would we do? If this happens, what would we do? So really, you know, thinking about those things. I think that the challenge with birth plans, of course, is that things don't always go how you want them to. And I think, you know, completely external to MS, you know, people come in with very detailed birth plans and sometimes feel very cheated if things don't go how they wanted it to and how they felt it should go. So I think some of this is around saying, well, this is what I want. This is how I'd like things to go. But also, if this happens and things aren't going how I want them to do, what will I do? And actually thinking through some of those options as well, in the same way that I would encourage anyone to do so, just because things don't always go how you plan. And if you're someone living with MS, you kind of know that already because you've been diagnosed with this thing that you didn't ask for. So, you know, being aware of that and actually having that discussion up front can be really helpful. And often, you know, if you do that, actually you feel much more prepared for all the eventualities.
Yeah, I think that sounds like a really sensible approach. And yeah, people with MS are sort of almost experienced in dealing with unpredictable situations sometimes. So yeah,
exactly. So use that inner knowledge that you've already, you know, you've built around that.
So the next few questions were around breastfeeding. So is it okay to breastfeed when you have MS? And how does it work with the hormones that are involved with breastfeeding? Do they have any sort of protective effect against relapses?
Yeah, so firstly to say, absolutely it's okay to breastfeed with MS. MS shouldn't stop people from breastfeeding. Again, thinking about some people who may have sort of specific disabilities, it may be that you need a bit more help from breastfeeding counsellors, from breastfeeding services to work out the mechanics of, you know, how to hold the baby to achieve successful breastfeeding. Breastfeeding is something that you have to learn as a partnership between you and the baby. It's not easy. It doesn't come to most people very naturally. And some people, regardless of physical disability, need more help than others with that. And particularly in people with some specific disabilities, they're more likely to need help with that. But so I think the first thing is to say MS isn't a reason not to breastfeed, but don't be afraid to ask for help if that's what you want to do. In terms of breastfeeding and relapse protection, we think that exclusive breastfeeding or exclusive breastfeeding with pumping does provide protection against relapses for at least around 3 months after birth, potentially up to six. So it's sort of slightly time limited to the first bit when the baby's quite young before they start weaning. It's not perfect. You know, it's probably equivalent to a fairly moderate efficacy DMT at best. These studies are quite difficult to interpret because in all of the breastfeeding studies pretty much to date, people chose between restarting their DMT or breastfeeding. It was at a time when we said, when people were being given the advice that they couldn't breastfeed whilst taking DMT. So people made that choice based on disease activity to a certain degree. You know, if somebody had very, very active MS, they may well choose to restart their disease modifying therapy rather than breastfeed. And so that makes some of the information from the studies a bit tricky to interpret because people aren't choosing in kind of isolation. They're choosing to breastfeed based on lots of things. Having said all of that, you know, neurologists are now increasingly comfortable with people breastfeeding, at least on certain medication. And so if you're somebody with higher disease activity, if you're somebody that's keen to think about breastfeeding on disease modifying therapy, then definitely have that conversation with your neurologist. So it may be that you can start a breastfeeding safe disease modifying therapy in that postpartum period.
Great. So sticking on the breastfeeding topic, I'm not sure if you'll know the answer to this one. So in terms of like the mechanisms of how breastfeeding works, can MS affect that at all? So could any MS damage interfere with the messages that trigger a milk letdown, for example?
So not directly in terms of the MS, but with breastfeeding and particularly with tiny babies, positioning is everything. Mm-hmm. So sort of some of the physical disabilities that people might have or the physical challenges that people might have with MS can prove an additional barrier or an additional challenge to getting that positioning absolutely right. Mm-hmm. So not in terms of kind of very direct, pretty clearly indirectly that it can. Yeah. But those things are often overcomable, but might require some external help to work out exactly how to get that right.
Mm-hmm. And I think you touched on this a little bit already. If you want to breastfeed, is it safe to do that if you are taking a disease modifying drug?
Yeah, so that very much depends on the disease modifying drug that you're taking. Mm-hmm. In general, there are some DMTs that would be sort of completely comfortable with people breastfeeding on, some where it might be a bit more of an individual discussion with your neurologist, and some, again, particularly those that are not safe during pregnancy as well, that we would say that these aren't compatible with breastfeeding.
And in terms of sort of postnatal support, so it must be really hard for women with MS that have had a baby, they're sort of caring for their newborn, and they're also dealing with MS symptoms on top of everything else. So how can sort of women with MS and their partners and families prepare for that sort of postnatal period and make sure that they've got sort of support in place? Like, what support potentially is there available to them?
Oh, that's a big question. And it's really hard because to some degree, particularly with first babies, I think you don't know what it's going to be like until you're in the midst of it, unfortunately. I think one of the key things is to, and it can be very difficult to ask for help, but to ask for help if you need it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are now all manner of support services available. And sometimes the extent that it can be quite difficult to know where to turn, like, is this the right person for this? Is this the right person for this? And I think to some degrees, it's a case of not worrying about whether this is the right person for this question, but just asking the question, because if it's not the right person, they will still want to try and help you and point you in the right direction. We know that postnatal mood disorders appear to be slightly more common in people with MS than people without, and including in fathers living with MS whose partners have given birth. So if you are feeling that your mood is low, particularly, that's very, very treatable. And it's really important to ask for support with that. You know, in terms of family support, every family is different. And it's really impossible to give advice on what family, because what could be right for some families could be completely the wrong thing for other families. And it's about knowing your family unit and what might help and those dynamics. And, you know, a tiny baby throws all kinds of things, new challenges into those dynamics. I think a lot of people do find that with fatigue, particularly sort of having partners to help feed overnight, sort of with an expressed breast milk, or finding ways to be able to build periods of kind of downtime into the day can be quite helpful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I suppose it's a very individual thing as well, isn't it? Like, looking at your MS symptoms and sort of potentially what areas you might be more tricky for you sort of post-birth. But yeah, very, very individual for each family. Moving on a bit into sort of women's lives as they get older and thinking about the menopause now. So we do hear from people that sort of think they're in the sort of perimenopause phase. So they're having these symptoms, but quite often they might overlap with MS symptoms as well. So it can be confusing trying to work out what's going on. So how can you sort of tell the difference between what's MS and what's menopause symptoms, and how can people get support for this?
I smile because you can't. Question I get asked a lot in clinic, you know, is this my MS or is this my menopause? And it's I don't know. It's probably both. It's really hard. So if you're finding it hard, I suppose I don't know if it's reassuring or not, but one of the things to say is that you're not alone in finding, sort of trying to ascribe that hard. So many people do. And it can be impossible, and it can, you know, quite commonly it can be both. What I would say is sometimes we end up doing something pretty pragmatic and saying, well, let's treat it as if it's one of these. Mm. What happens? Does it get better? Yes or no? If it doesn't, well, okay, that treatment's not worked. Let's try treating the other one. Because so many of the symptoms, so fatigue, poor sleep, you know, cognitive fog, urinary and bladder symptoms, sexual dysfunction. They're common to both. You see them both in MS and menopause, and you can see that the symptoms can be essentially indistinguishable. So it is often a case of trying to treat one, seeing what happens. One of the things that I would say, particularly if you're female and you think you are perimenopausal, is that often menopausal symptoms are easier to treat than MS symptoms. And so with topical hormones, with HRT, with sort of, you know, again, similar to many other things I've talked about today, that HRT approaches have become much more complex and much more targeted. Whereas often with some of the symptomatic treatments that we use in MS, they're actually a bit less effective. They work, you know, they can work, but they may well not work. Whereas HRT, the treatments tend to be pretty effective. So particularly if somebody's having other perimenopausal symptoms, I'd be tempted to go in with hormonal therapies first off for some of those shared treatments to see what impact they have.
Mm-hmm. And is that something that people can talk to their GP about?
Yes, the GP is a really good sort of first stop for menopause symptoms. I think often people find, and one of the challenges people find, they talk to their neurologist, and the neurologist just says, talk to GP, hormones, HRT, and they feel a bit sort of like that's the end of the discussion. And I think in some ways it's very unfair to criticize neurologists for that, because actually we're not general practitioners, we're not sort of HRT doctors, and actually it is very much outside our scope of training and experience. So it's about where we can help as neurologists is by empowering people and have those conversations and to say, look, you know, we know this is a real challenge in MS, and we think that if this is felt to be menopause, then HRT is safe in MS. Okay, so you know, it's almost like we can do some myth busting. HRT is safe in MS. MS isn't a reason not to have HRT. And obviously there are concerns about HRT. It's not for everyone. There are, you know, particular risks associated with some forms of HRT. But to have that discussion again as somebody without MS would have.
Mm-hmm. My final question is still about the menopause. So how can women with MS best look after their bone health? Are women with MS more at risk of their bones getting weaker?
Yeah, so there is evidence that people with MS are more likely to have what we call fragility fractures, so fractures associated with poor bone health, than people without MS. And this is probably not just due to weak bones, it's also due to the physical effects of MS, MS making it more likely to have a fall, for example. And, you know, particularly in people with more advanced MS, you know, weight bearing actually helps to protect your bones. If you're doing less weight bearing exercise, that can impact on your bones. It's probably from quite a lot of things that we see this final effect on fractures. Having said that, it kind of highlights that actually looking after bone health is really important in MS. And one of the reasons I came to be interested in menopause was actually via bone health. And you know, we do know that HRT does have a protective effect on bones. And I think that is a good reason for people with MS to at least have that conversation, even saying it's not for everyone. I also think that there is other very good advice out there around bone health that's not necessarily drug related. So, you know, continuing to do weight bearing exercise where it's possible, stopping smoking, making sure you're not drinking too much, you know, seeking out DEXA scans and taking bone protective medications if those are indicated, are all important alongside considering HRT to help protect bone. So I think the answer is yes, but I think there's a lot of things that we can all do to try and protect our own bone health.
Mm. Yeah, it sounds like there's quite a few things there that people can be doing to look after themselves. That's all of the questions I've got. Thank you so much for answering them all in such detail. I'm sure there were some topics there that we could have elaborated on.
One last thing, which I was waiting for the right opportunity, never quite came to drop it in. While thinking about pregnancy or are pregnant, please do consider signing up for the pregnancy registry, which if you Google UKMS pregnancy registry, it's the first hit on Google.
Oh, brilliant. Yeah, it's really important to gather data on that to help other women that
yeah. So we've got over 250 people in and it's brilliant. We're getting some really nice results out, but we always need more.
Oh yes, definitely.
Now, if this was a commercial podcast, here is where there would be an advert. But we're a charity, so we don't do that. Instead, we would like to take this opportunity to tell you all about our fantastic resources for people with MS.
Yes, so our website, mstrust.org.uk, has lots of information and resources for people affected by MS. We have our A to Z, which has got information covering all of the topics I spoke to Ruth about, so hormones, pregnancy, menopause, plus lots more. So head to the website, mstrust.org.uk, and click on A to Z of MS to read more.
And now over to my chat with Libby. I am here now with Olivia Mason, who is one of our fantastic MS Trust fundraisers. That's how we got to hear about her. And I actually follow her myself on Instagram. So when we decided that we were going to do a podcast talking about women's health and talking about things like pregnancy and starting a family, I thought, I know a perfect guest for this podcast. So, but without me just talking about you, how about you tell us a little bit about yourself and who you are and maybe share a bit about your MS journey?
Thanks, Helena. Yeah, so I'm Olivia, or also known as Livy. I'm trying to think of my age then. I'm a 34-year-old mum. So my daughter's nearly two. And I was diagnosed with MS in May last year. So my symptoms started February last year. So it was quite a quick diagnosis, yeah. I think, compared to a lot of people. Yeah. So symptom onset early Feb, and received the diagnosis May. Started treatment August. So it's actually been a really quick journey. That's it in a nutshell, I suppose. And here we are just over a year later, I suppose, of diagnosis, and have done some fundraising for MS Trust and run a London Marathon for them. So yeah.
Very excited about having you on board for the marathon. But yeah, that is a very quick kind of turnaround, because I think you hear so many people that have to wait years and years and things, so then it's positive to hear that, you know, that it is quick and that they offer treatment and everything quickly.
Yeah, definitely. I do feel really lucky that it was quick, and I will say I did kind of I think you've got to really advocate for yourself. So I had the symptoms in the Feb, and all of the team were brilliant at sort of, you know, doing the tests and the scans. Yeah. There was then quite a long wait to get a lumbar puncture, which was to do the sort of, you know, to tick all the boxes, I suppose. And I wasn't willing to wait. So was in a fortunate position that I could pay to see a neurologist privately in London, who then transferred my NHS care. So I didn't have to pay privately for the lumbar puncture, but my NHS care just transferred to a London trust. And they got me a lumbar puncture within a matter of weeks. And then that sped things up a little bit for me, because I just wasn't willing to wait.
No. So take me back to when you first started experiencing symptoms. How old was your daughter then?
Yeah, so she was 8 months old. Okay. 8 months old. So still a little baby. Just started weaning, I suppose, for a couple of months. I was still breastfeeding around the clock. And it actually started at a soft play. So I was at a soft play center with her, and I had a numb foot and leg, and I thought it was just because I'd been on my knees at soft play for multiple hours. And then it was only when I was then driving home with her and I realized I couldn't really feel the pedal beneath my foot, which probably wasn't that safe, but I thought I just need to get home. And again, I thought, oh, that's really weird. I must have been sat funny. Took her for a walk in the buggy to sort of shake things out. Yeah. By the time I was back from that walk, the numbness had spread all the way up to my hip. So it only made it worse.
Oh, wow. That's quite quick then.
Yeah.
And what did you do? Did you go to your GP?
Or? So I just thought it was a trapped nerve and went to bed as normal. And then I remember going to the toilet in the middle of the night and sort of just my legs just sort of collapsed beneath me. I just couldn't really walk, and I was like, okay, that is weird. But again, I thought I just must have a trapped nerve. It was only when I then went to the toilet and I couldn't really feel myself going to the toilet, and that's when I thought, that is strange. And a quick Google, funny enough, MS wasn't the thing that came up. It was something called cauda equina. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a spinal condition that requires quite quick surgery.
Yeah.
So I went to the GP the next day and they suspected that or Guillain-Barre. Yeah. They were like, it could be one of these things. So they actually did a scan that day of my lower spine because they said, yeah, if it is the other thing, we have to do immediate surgery.
Yeah.
And that came back clear because they just scanned that lumbar part, yeah, of my spine and there was nothing there. And they were like, you have the healthiest spine. You're fine.
Oh, thank like, you.
Oh, okay. And they were so reassured. They were like, yeah, it's fine. Just go home.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, okay. And then things did get a bit worse and then it spread up my arm. I started losing dexterity.
Yeah.
As I was eating, I couldn't swallow. And then I thought, no, something's really not, yeah, right. Went back and they did a full spinal and head. And that's when they found spinal lesions in the thoracic spine and brain. So, yeah.
So when they, you said scan first, did you have an MRI scan the first time?
It was an MRI scan, yeah, but just of that bottom part of the spine. So yeah, just, very small section. So it didn't show anything. So they did everything that they, you know, was,
yeah,
what they needed to do. But yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. My father-in-law had Guillain-Barre and I do remember they having to move quite quickly because obviously it was spreading so fast.
Yeah,
Sort of the numbness and things. So
and I think it affects both sides,
yeah,
Guillain-Barre. And because mine was just one side, that's, yeah, when they ruled that out. So, yeah.
No, but it's really good to hear how quick they were reacting. But they could have saved some time if they would have scanned a little bit more than...
Yeah, I know. It's just, that's what the neurologist said. He said, oh, these lesions are just above where they scan. So it's, it was only a few days apart, I think, the scan. So not too much time was lost.
And what were your sort of initial thoughts and feelings then?
So at this point, I sort of thought, knew MS was a possible diagnosis, mm-hmm, that they were going to come to me with, because who doesn't go on Google? Everyone, yeah, goes on Google. So I work full-time in the NHS as a dietitian, and I'd worked on a lot of acute hospitals and I'd treated a lot of patients with MS, further, you know, advanced MS, where their swallowing was so affected that they needed feeding tubes. That was my only real experience, yeah, of MS. So immediately I thought, oh my gosh, like, what could this mean? But I think once I realized that MS today looks very different for a lot of people, not for everyone, but for a lot of people, yeah, it does look different because medicine's come a long way. Once I realized that, I think I've actually been quite positive about it. I just cracked on. I think it actually affected my husband more than it did me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I suppose when you have a tiny baby as well, there is not that much time to actually sit down and stop and think about your situation. You just have to deal with what's going on in her life.
Yeah, that's it. And like I said, at the time, I was still the breastfeeding around the clock. And I remember my husband bringing her into the hospital. And that's when the doctor came along and sort of said, oh, can we find a private room? Hmm. And I remember I was sort of like, oh, she needs feeding. So I was like breastfeeding her. And he said, I couldn't really absorb it because I was just so focused on, yeah, her. I hadn't seen her for hours. And, you know, if you breastfed, you know how full your boobs can feel after not feeding for a while. And I was like, I just need to feed her.
Oh, it's so relief.
Yeah. And I almost wasn't hearing what he was saying. And he was, at first they diagnosed clinically isolated syndrome. And he was,
yeah,
explaining this could be MS,
yeah,
but I was listening, but I wasn't really listening. yeah, it was a weird feeling.
Oh, I bet. No, and I can fully, when I was breastfeeding, it is, you are very task focused, and when it's painful, it is really painful, and you just have to see the baby and you kind of know, okay, just come here now.
Yeah.
But did they then try to give you any treatments? Because I know that is one thing. I had a relapse when I had my second son, and I had optic neuritis, and they wanted to give me some steroids for it. But because I was breastfeeding, I sort of said no to that because obviously they don't like steroids to go into the breast.
Yeah, milk. Yeah. And they did offer me steroids, yeah, but because it had been by this point, I think about a week of symptoms and things were tailing off, I declined them because things were improving. So I didn't take the steroids, and eventually after, I don't know, 6 to 8 weeks, the symptoms, I've still got some residual symptoms, but, yeah, most of that numbness went away. So yeah, I didn't take the steroids.
when sort of thinking back before, I don't know, like do you think you've had any other Emma symptoms before you were diagnosed?
Yeah, so the only thing I can think of, it's funny, isn't it? Because I remember when the doctor first asked me, I thought, well, no. But then when I'd had a really good think about it, back in 2018, I was training for London Marathon and I had a numb left foot, so the same left side that went numb, and it was just the foot and it spread all the way sort of up to the ankle. And I just put it down to my trainers being too tight. And it still could be that. And I remember chatting it through with my neurologist and he said, yeah, that could have been your first relapse, or it could have been your shoes were too tight. We'll never know because I never had an MRI with contrast. But where my lesions are on the spine, there's two very close together. And he said it could have been that 2018 was one of these and the one next to it is the one now. But
yeah,
we don't know.
Because It's interesting what you're saying, because I think when they talk about pregnancy and MS, they often say that people who are pregnant are fairly well because of the sort of the immune system kind of lowering itself to allow you to carry the baby without complicating. But then when you are breastfeeding, it say that there might be a bit of protection too. But then as you start weaning, then, you know, less of that protection is there and then your immune system starts kicking in. Yeah. So potentially... because I remember for me, when I had my first son, that was when I suddenly started noticing tingling and things like that when I was weaning him. As the breastfeeding was being reduced, then I suddenly noticed that, oh, now my symptoms are coming back. Because, you know, apart from feeling tired and worn out as you do during pregnancy, I was MS-wise feeling quite well.
Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it?
But I do feel, you know, there is a bit of talk about MS and hormones and the sort of ups and downs. And you certainly can sort of see about pregnancy that could be, if they say it's a bit of protection, but what's happening. Have you noticed anything, like if we're talking about, say, your monthly cycle when it comes to your symptoms?
Yeah, I think so. The days running up to my cycle and then whilst I'm, you know, menstruating, definitely I have a sort of slight flare up, because I think even without MS, you tend to feel more fatigued on those days. And, you know, the fatigue sets in and then I get a little bit of tingling. So, definitely there's some impact there. I don't know what the science says in terms of how, you know, it works for females' hormones and MS symptoms. But I definitely notice a difference.
What sort of day-to-day symptoms have you got now? Is the numbness sort of okay at the moment?
So the numbness is okay. Although I say that, this last month, I've been really struggling with fatigue, and I actually went into an acute symptom clinic last week, and they did the usual, you know, with the pin to test, you know. And actually, I am still quite numb, which I didn't realise, because they're poking me, and I was like, nope, can't feel it, which surprised me. But the most bothersome symptoms are, it's more tingling all through the left side of my face. Dexterity in this, my left hand, is quite poor, but it only really comes on when I'm run down, tired, stressed. When I'm well and I'm well rested, I would say I don't really notice symptoms. You know, I'm quite lucky in that I can go day to day without really thinking about MS. But when I'm run down, then it definitely rears its head. And then running, I get a tiny bit of foot drop when I'm fatigued and I'm further into the run. But I think with training, it's actually getting better. So,
and do you find that helps with fatigue? Running?
I do, actually. And I try explaining that to people and it doesn't make sense, because they're like, well, really, your fatigue can't be that bad because you went and ran 18 miles at the weekend. And I'm like, yeah, but getting out for the run's actually really helpful. It's funny, isn't it?
It's a really hard thing to explain. But I'm in the same boat, because I feel like if I don't do exercise or move, then my fatigue goes so bad that it's sort of those levels, isn't it? It's like, well, either I'm just sat on the sofa the whole day and feeling really tired, or I go out for a run and then I will have a nice window afterwards where I will feel quite energized. And then the fatigue will, obviously, it will set in later on, but that chunk of good time in the middle plus the run wouldn't have been there if I wouldn't have exercised. That's sort of how I try to explain it, but it's really tricky to explain. Had you been running all your life?
No. So I only took up running in, I think it was 2016. I was living in Hong Kong with my husband at the time, and we yeah, we just, gym memberships over there were extortionately expensive, and I was trying to find a way to keep fit, and yeah, I found running, and I've run ever since.
You were mentioning sort of when you feel run down and worn out. Now, having babies both comes with sleep deprivation, and it then does tend to come with a lot of germs and things if children goes into nursery. How is that situation going?
Yeah, you might be able to tell that I'm quite bunged up at the moment, because my daughter brings back something new for me every week. Sleep deprivation's been really hard. My daughter has never been a sleeper. And I think there's some myth around like that babies are good. You know, they say, I slept like a baby. Babies don't sleep.
No, they don't, do they?
And my daughter just hasn't ever slept. And she's now nearly two and still wakes multiple times a night. So navigating that with MS, when your MS team is saying how important sleep is, is really hard, because my husband takes a lot of the nights now that I'm not breastfeeding. He's able to help more, but I also still can't expect him to do every night, because he also has a full-time job. So it's really tricky. I've kind of accepted that I'm in a stage of life where I'm going to be sleep deprived. And I prioritize it where I can. If I can get to bed early, I will. And on days that I'm really fatigued, then my husband will say, I'll be in with her tonight. You have the bed to yourself and get a good night's sleep. So we sort of share the load a little bit.
That's really important, isn't it? And I think it's just that when you're in that bubble, especially when they're, you know, when they're weaning and there's no kind of, it's up and down with the sleeps and naps and before you sort of come into a bit of a routine, I feel like you just have to tell yourself, this too shall pass. You know, you're not going to have an 18-year-old that wants to sleep in your bed and it's going to scream to you.
That's what I keep telling myself.
I do feel like the sleep like a baby is a very strange term. I would say sleep like a teenager. I have a 14-year-old son, and he can sleep. He can sleep like that's the dead. I mean, do you try to? I always thought the advice would be like, kind of sleep when they're napping. Is she napping at all?
She does still nap once a day, normally around 1 o'clock for about 90 minutes. But I mean, I'm back at full-time work now, so I don't
nap then.
Nap when she naps, because I'm at work. Sometimes on the weekend, though, like especially if I do my long run in the morning, I will then put her down for a nap, and sometimes I will either just lie next to her or nap with her on the weekend, because I do need it. So I have been doing that more recently.
You said you started on treatment. Can you talk us through that?
I started on Ocrevus in August. So I had my first two half doses they give it, and then I've got my next full dose this Friday. That all started really quickly. The neurologist that I saw was very pro starting you on strong treatment early. I think that's what the evidence is leading to now. And I had stopped breastfeeding by the time that came around, although I do believe you can breastfeed on Ocrevus. I was given all options, you know, the two that were recommended were Ocrevus and Kesimpta. And I was actually leading more towards Kesimpta, and I cannot remember the details of it all, but with future family planning, the way they put it to me was Ocrevus was less like maths involved with terms of weaning off and stuff. I don't know why, I was so tired. I just remember going, okay, if that's what you think. And actually, it's quite nice, because it's only twice a year I have to think about it.
It does get very complicated with the drugs. I mean, I think it's great that we have such a big choice between things, but at the same time, you do almost need to draw those. It's like that meme, you know, with the people thinking with all the maths going around, and you're sort of going, "How is this?" But I think when I first got to do the choice, there was much less to look at, and then it sort of gradually built up, and there was some talk about me potentially changing my drug, and I was like, oh no, do I have to go through all this again now? But it does, especially if you are thinking of having future children as well, because obviously does some of them clear out the system very quickly, others take longer time, and then some have sort of issues perhaps with if you can have children in the future as well. So yeah. I feel like it's obviously really important that you get it right.
Yeah.
But how have the side effects been? Have you been feeling
fine?
Wrong?
I didn't really. I want to say that I've probably caught more common colds and things like that since being on it. But also, my daughter is in full time childcare and brings back things, so it could be a mixture of those. You know, it does lower your immune system, so I'd be more susceptible to catching things. But doesn't help that she brings back lots of bugs all the time. So other than that, I feel a few I did feel tired a few days after the infusion, but otherwise I've been absolutely fine.
When you said before about the sort of day-to-day symptoms and tingling and stuff, have you ever been to talk to any, you know, MS nurse or any pain clinics or anything to give you any ways to deal with that?
I haven't been to any like pain clinics, but I have. So my MS team, I feel really fortunate. They've been really, really good. So I've had quite a long appointment with the nurse when I was first diagnosed and a review with her. I've had OT input for fatigue management. That has been really helpful. And then I've also had physio input in terms of me training for the London Marathon. And all of that combined, I think, has been helpful. For the tingling, like, it doesn't cause me any pain. It's just more annoying. So I haven't needed to see anyone about it. Another day-to-day thing I have is with my bladder as well. I always need the toilet. So they have talked through things like limiting caffeine and all those usual things. I do love my coffee and tea, so
that must be funny when you're a dietitian as well, because it's like, you know, all the things and you kind of feel like, well, yes, but I still love it. I'm the same. My bladder is overactive. I run and I love coffee, so curse.
So, you know, I've seen them for things like that, but as a team, they've been brilliant.
It's really nice to hear, because obviously having had your daughter before all this started, you haven't really had the sort of, but if you were to have more children, I guess you would have your MS team involved in those kind of folks. So I think it's interesting, isn't it, because you have a team that's looking after you, and when you're pregnant, that's the other time, like when you actually have a whole team of people that are looking after you. So it's a kind of, it's quite an interesting thing to have the two sit together. It doesn't always work, I found in my experience, but it's really important to have a good MS team, so I'm very pleased.
I do feel fortunate. I haven't met my actual local neurologist yet, because I've only met the one that I went to see in London, so I think I meet him this summer, but I'm sure he'll be fantastic.
What would you say to people who are thinking about having children, because I guess a lot of people are worried, maybe not so much about, you know, pregnancy, have got all those bits to worry about, but like actually coping when you are tired, when you are struggling with fatigue, and to look after a little, very active, non-sleeping baby.
And I think those are really valid worries. I know people say, you know, MS shouldn't be a reason not to have children. And there's no contraindication to that, but they're still valid reasons to be worried about those things. And, you know, my husband and I have had this chat about a second child as well, and how that could affect us and my MS. And, you know, those are the conversations that we're having and that we should have. So I think, first of all, you've got to think about your MS. Like, we know, it's a snowflake disease, isn't it? Everyone is different. So how it affects, think about how it affects you. You know, if you are someone who perhaps does need to spend most days all in bed and really struggles with fatigue, it's just thinking about, well, what support network will I have around me to help bring up a child? You know, what input can my partner have? Have those conversations with your partner. They say it raises a village, you know, you need a village, to raise a child, but not everyone has a village.
No.
So we're really lucky that my husband's parents live local. They're very helpful. That's a luxury that not everyone has. I think you've just got to consider your own situation, but if you want to have kids, then MS shouldn't stop you. But, you know, if if you really struggle with MS and day-to-day symptoms, like have a little, you know, you have to think about these things and you have a choice. Don't let societal pressures dictate whether you have children or not. But yeah, MS shouldn't be a barrier to having kids, but appreciate for some people it's valid if it is a barrier.
No, absolutely. And it's funny with, you know, having children, you can read all the material, you can know other people with babies, and you can, I don't know, have small siblings, but you still don't know what you're in for until you actually have that child there.
And every child is so different, isn't it? Like I was saying, said to my husband, surely if we have a second, there'll be a better sleeper. And my husband was like, yeah, but it could be worse. I'm like, oh my God, really? But yeah, it could be worse.
No, it's so true. My first son, he wasn't a great sleeper, but once he got into a routine, he slept, and this is the teenager who sleeps very well now. But my second son, he pretty much wanted to sleep in my armpits from the day when he was born till he was a toddler. But then he's all good, you know. But it's considering they're made from the same genetic makeup, but they're just so very different when it comes.
Yeah, and I think other thing, you know, it's not just think about breastfeeding as well, because actually yes, breastfeeding is a protective factor in terms of relapses and things like that, but it's exhausting. And if they are breastfeeding around the clock and don't accept a bottle, well then all of that responsibility is on you, because that was the case with me. My daughter, we tried and tried with every bottle going on the market and she just wouldn't take one. So it was all on me to feed day and night, and that took a toll on my body. And whether that had an impact on the relapse or not, we don't know, but I firmly believe it did.
As a dietitian, have you got any good sort of tips on how you actually stay healthy, both I guess both during pregnancy but then also when you are breastfeeding? Because
I think it's important to first of all have enough. Like obviously breastfeeding really takes it out of you. You use a lot of calories to breastfeed. A lot of people have this misconception that if you breastfeed you'll lose the baby weight. Actually a lot of people don't lose that additional weight. You need those extra stores to be able to feed the baby. So eating enough, and it's really hard to obviously eat enough of what people might say the right foods. You should be eating well, you know, varied diet. But sometimes when you're really sleep deprived, it's really hard. You just grab what you can. I remember sort of just grabbing a bowl of cereal here and there. I'm really lucky that my husband enjoys cooking. So often he would leave me a nice healthy lunch so that I would be less inclined to just grab a bowl of cereal. I mean, it is just having a balanced diet, isn't it?
And
having enough. I think people focus on restriction too much, but actually have enough.
Yes, that's again, we're talking about the society and pressure. I mean, it is such a silly thing, isn't it? You've just given birth, you have this baby, you should not be thinking about getting into jeans and looking, you know, it's about you and your baby now.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. And yeah, I know for me that breastfeeding, I definitely didn't, you know, if anything, I think I maybe even gained weight because I was hungry all the time, but I was listening to that hunger and I was feeding my body, and my body was doing this amazing thing at feeding my baby. And eventually, not that you do need to drop the weight, but eventually weight did come back off.
That's the thing. I mean, that kind of connection that you have with the baby is it's worth anything, isn't it? Because I feel like, you know, people have to do whatever they got to do. I had a lot of issues with breastfeeding myself, but once we actually got going properly, I mean, that connection is just amazing, isn't it? It's very hard to explain, but you can really feel all the happy chemicals going in your brain. So even if you haven't slept for days, it's still like some kind of popping. But do you find now then sort of now you got a toddler instead, because then there is obviously a lot of running around and rushing about, because they don't tend to sit still, toddlers, do they?
No. And if you try to sit her still, she does the back option, you know.
I remember that.
So lots of running around after her. yeah, in a way, actually, I think this stage of motherhood is more exhausting than the baby stage, which I didn't think would be the case. But no, it is, especially because I'm now balancing full-time work with raising her and then training for a marathon. I don't think I thought that through.
That's a lot. It's
a lot going on. I think my MS team did sort of, they warned me when I told them my plans for the marathon. Is it a good idea? And more recently, I think I've been not trying to talk me out of it, but have, you know, I've been really struggling with fatigue and they're pinning it on the marathon training, which is valid. But I don't think I quite realised the toll it was going to take. But it's worth it.
Oh,
it's fine.
We're so happy that you're running the marathon for us. But no, I having had trained for a few marathons back in, I haven't done it for a few years now, but it's a lot of it is just mental as well, isn't it? It's yes, you get tired from the, but then it's not that sort of worry about, well, if I can't go out for my run today, what will happen then? And this isn't, you know, you put a lot of pressure on yourself, and sometimes it's actually just okay to miss a run. It's not going to make or break things, is it?
No, that's it. And I think last time I was training for a marathon, if I missed a run, I would make up for that. I would be like, okay, well, I'll run double next time, and actually, that probably isn't the right approach. And this time, if I've missed a run, I've just gone, okay, I've missed it.
Yeah. I think maybe sometimes having children kind of refocuses your priorities a little bit.
And it's, definitely, yeah.
On a very positive way. No, you kind of feel like, well, actually, I'm here and now, and I'm going to enjoy that.
yeah.
So have you got any parting advice for somebody who's listening to this? And I mean, we've already spoken about how to look after yourself, but like, what would be your sort of thing to say to someone who might be a new mum?
New mum with MS.
Yeah.
I think reach out to those around you. I've been really open about my MS diagnosis with my close friends and my close mum friends. I've made some really great mum friends since having Ophelia, my daughter, and have been really open with them, and they have been my rocks, as well as my husband. They've been amazing, just to have as people to vent to. And you know if you're just having a bad day, also if I just need them to have Ophelia for that, they've had her when I've had to go into the hospital for appointments and things, that's been really, really handy. Trying to get sleep. If you're a new mum and you're off work, then everyone says sleep when the baby sleeps, but genuinely if you can, then do. Or even if you just lie on the sofa, if they're sleeping on you, contact naps. Just lie on the sofa and watch Netflix. I made the most of maternity leave. I made the most of it, and I don't regret a single nap on that sofa.
No, when people run around and trying to sort out their house and things.
If it's your first child as well, and you don't know if you don't want a second, or don't know if you can have a second, then it's the only time that you really can switch off. Because you know, if I was to go on and have a second, maternity leave won't look the same, because I also have a toddler. So I feel like I really maximise the opportunity to rest. So I think.
Don't feel guilty about it.
no, don't. Because whatever you're doing, I think I saw this quote on Instagram, but it's whatever you are doing is important. Because sometimes on maternity leave, I think it feels like you're not doing anything fulfilling or important. But actually, changing a nappy, that is important.
Yeah,
baby needs a nappy change. Feeding them is important. Putting the laundry on is important. They're all important tasks. So yeah.
You still keep on growing this little human. It's not growing inside you, but it's still you helping it grow, aren't you? So it is very important. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
And thanks for having me.
Best of luck for the London Marathon. I will be there cheering you on.
Yes.
Are you looking forward to it?
I am. I'm really looking forward to it. And I've ran London in 2018, so I'm really looking forward to that buzz of the atmosphere. Yeah. I think that's what's going to get me around, as opposed to my fitness. So, yeah, I'm excited.
Looking forward to seeing you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Helena.
That was so interesting. I loved listening to both of the guests. I've always wondered about the sort of hormone link to MS, because I remember when I was first sort of diagnosed within that first year, I always used to have a tingling arm every time my period was about to come on. And it was one of those, you know, it was almost like I didn't have to look in the calendar. I knew just by how tingly my arm that this was about to happen. But then when I fell pregnant, that just stopped. And I find that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think it just shows, doesn't it, that there's your hormones are working away, doing something there, doesn't it? And I suppose it's interesting as well that other women might not notice any difference, but some women might sort of know straight away that their period's coming because of something like that, where their MS symptoms do flare up a little bit beforehand or sort of when their period first starts.
Yeah, and I also feel like, you know, with pregnancy, for me, it was... I felt great through the pregnancy. Well, I say I feel great through the pregnancy. I was still tired because I was being pregnant, but I didn't notice any of my MS symptoms at all, apart from, you know, fatigue. But like I said, it's hard to know whether that was fatigue from being pregnant or not. But then I've heard stories from other women who have been expecting, who really struggled through their pregnancy as well. But I guess because the immune system sort of calms down a little bit, that's generally why we feel a little bit better through pregnancy, I think.
Yeah, and I think obviously sort of it's very different for different women, but on the helpline and I think on our Facebook group as well, I've seen quite a few women with MS that have found they've felt quite good during their pregnancy. So yeah, it's very individual to the person, but I think that's probably quite a common experience.
Yeah. And I think in my first pregnancy, I didn't have a relapse afterwards, but I did in my second, about the, I think it was, well, it was probably 10 months later, I think. I was sort of coming towards, he was starting to be weaned. So I think I was breastfeeding less and I got optic neuritis. And that's how I ended up being put on DMT. So after, but it was interesting hearing Livy's story because clearly, you know, it went very quickly for her, who she was sort of diagnosed and then straight out there. And then they wanted to put her on treatment whilst I didn't have to sort of think about treatment while I was still breastfeeding. But there's a lot of things to think about.
Yeah, definitely. And I think as Ruth was saying, it sort of forces you to sort of forward plan a little bit and think about these things when you've got MS and you're having a baby. You do have to think ahead a little bit more.
Yeah, and that's not always easy because I guess some babies kind of just appear. I was going to say that sounded a bit funny, but you know, it's not all pregnancies are planned, are they?
Oh, no.
So yeah, it's tricky, but it's been really interesting to listen to both of the guests. It's funny timing with this podcast because in my spirit of oversharing on the podcast, but I actually started HRT this week myself. it's strange because I think I've heard a lot of people, you know, struggling to get it. And I feel like now when we talk so much about it, because it certainly has been in the press a lot. And I guess with the, you know, all the stuff that Davina did with it, I think they raised a lot of awareness over a few years ago. I think it was about 2.5 years ago I started having issues, which I thought were MS related first. I felt like I had a UTI. My bladder was really hurting. And ended up sort of going to the bladder clinic and they were sort of saying, no, it seems to be fine. But they sent me off for having a scan and they found out I had like some cysts on my ovaries. And then they said, this is clearly sort of perimenopausal stuff and you need to go and talk to your GP instead. And that GP was not very keen on trying me on HRT. I guess I was, how old was I then? 44 or something. So they put me on a mini pill instead. And that sort of made it okay, better. But I recently been starting to feel everything was just dragging and I'm feeling really tired and worn out, very anxious, sleeping really badly. So I spoke to my GP and she was like, well, why didn't they put you on HRT? it's a bit funny question because you kind of think, well, I don't know. I'm not the GP who's put me on the mini pill. So we decided to try that. So it's early days. I can't believe but I'm really pleased that it was easy to get because you hear some horror stories about people really struggling to get it.
Yeah, it's a shame, isn't it, when I think there's a lot of anxiety sort of about going to the GP and actually sort of talking about it, because a lot of people would have heard horror stories before, but I do think it's good that more people are talking about it now. It's definitely been in the media more, I think, like access to HRT, but yeah, it'll be interesting to to see if HRT works for you and if it has any impact on your MS symptoms. So yeah, I thought it was also interesting actually in what Ruth was saying in the interview around sort of how they approach sort of the question of, oh, is this an MS symptom or is this a menopausal symptom? So I thought it was really interesting to get her take on that as well.
Yeah, I like what she said about, you know, it's easier to treat if it is sort of menopausal related. So then, you know, go that way down that road first. And I thought that was really interesting. We mentioned at the start that Ruth's been in another podcast that we did, which was specifically about menopause. So if you want to hear more about menopause and MS, there is an entire podcast on this topic, and it's linked to in the show notes. So it was not only Ruth, but we also had Hetty, who was a person with MS, who spoke about her own experience with menopause.
So if you have any questions about MS, that could be anything that we've spoken about today or any other questions, we're here for you. You can call our helpline on 0800 032 3839. We're here Monday to Friday, 9 to 5, apart from UK bank holidays. Outside these hours, you can leave a message on our answer phone and we'll get back to you as soon as we can. Or you can email your questions to ask@mstrust.org.uk.
And you can also find us on social media, so on Facebook, YouTube, X, TikTok, and Instagram. And you can find this podcast wherever you listen to podcasts, really, but like Spotify, Google and Apple Podcast, and Amazon Music, and Audible as well. The video is up on YouTube if you want to see what we look like. We would love to hear what you think about this podcast. So, you know, if this is something that's... a topic that might have relating to your own experiences, so maybe about menopause or periods or pregnancy, breastfeeding. Would love to hear from you, so drop us some comments. And if you would want to leave us a review of the podcast, that's always great because it helps us reach more people. But thank you so much, Gemma, for being on the podcast. It's been fun.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.